Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. Welcome to General Talk, the first in a series of monthly podcasts in which we interview personalities from the Army and ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, to give you, the listener, a greater insight into the ever-changing role of the military in the modern world and the manner in which we, as the Army's national charity, safeguard the welfare of our soldiers, veterans and their immediate families. My guest for this opening interview is a soldier's soldier, if ever. Outspoken, granite-voiced and never afraid of controversy, commissioned into the Intelligence Corps in 1963, he transferred to the Parachute Regiment in 1970. Serving in Northern Ireland throughout the Troubles, he later went on to operations in the Balkans, including the Kosovo War, before taking up his appointment as Chief of the General Staff, the professional head of the Army, in 2003, a matter of weeks before the start of the Iraq War. Retiring in 2006, he became President of the Soldiers' Charity in 2012, a post he held until April of this year. One of Britain's most popular, characterful and high-profile senior officers of late, it is my great privilege to welcome General Sir Mike Jackson to the programme. General, hello. How are you after 3 months of lockdown?
Good morning. Well, still here. I'm still in one piece. I'm delighted to report.
Well, this is great news to hear. But let's go back to the beginning, as it were. Mm-hmm. And 1963, the Beatles released their first album. Doctor Who came to our screens. And at the age of 19, you joined the Army. What was the attraction then?
In fact, I joined the Army at the age of 17. 17 and three quarters, to be precise. Why did I become a soldier? Everybody asks me. I never know what the real answer is, other than that from the age of 15, I was pretty clear this is what I wanted to do.
And then the regular Army was nearly 260,000 strong with a reserves complement. How different did serving then feel to when you retired in 2006?
Well, by the time I left the Army in that year, 2006, we were down to 80-something thousand, I think, in the strength of the Army. Now, of course, when I joined, the Cold War was very cold. The whole strategic posture was deterrence of the then Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, and it needed mass. And so we had a comparatively large army for peacetime. Over the decades, it shrunk. It worries me that 80,000 may not be big enough.
And already they're talking about further cuts yet again, aren't they?
I fear so.
Mm-hmm. I know that when you retired, you said that one of your regrets was you never had the opportunity to fight a set-piece battle a la style of Montgomery or Alex or Slim. Do you think the British Army has the capability to fight such a battle today?
At a pinch. And I think it would take some preparation time. We are down to a position where really we can field, if we get it right, a single division, perhaps of two or three brigades. That is probably maximum effort we can expect from today's army.
Which is frightening by comparison to the divisions that we were able to put in the field then.
Yeah.
And of course, we haven't got the armour to go with it either, have we?
The armour?
Yeah.
Well, the Royal Armoured Corps is now pretty much a shadow of what it was when I joined in terms of numbers of armoured regiments.
Yeah, yeah. And tanks too.
Well, indeed, yes. Mm.
Yeah, let's go back to 1970. You transferred to the Parachute Regiment.
I did.
Had that always been an ambition from the outset?
No, I didn't think so. You know, I was a young officer cadet, at Sandhurst. I had spent my sixth form time with modern languages. Those were my A-levels. And one of them was Russian. And at a very tender age, I was persuaded that I should make use of such linguistic ability as I had, and I went to an intelligence school. As time went on, I came to the view that I got this wrong, that I'd be much happier in a combat arm, and hence I transferred. I mean, I first went to the parachute regiment on secondment, because quite rightly, intelligence corps felt its young officers should have some front line, if I can put it that way, experience. I did, and I'm afraid I was captured.
Do you think your desire to join the intelligence corps originally was perhaps in any way influenced by the rise then of Ian Fleming's James Bond? I mean, On Imagine Secret Service came out at the same time.
No, I don't think so.
No, nor the prospect of intelligence in the Cold War and fighting the intelligence war in that sense.
I don't think so. No, it was this question of languages, which perhaps was the most important factor in that original choice, which I then, as I say, realised was probably not best suited for me.
But from 1970 onwards, virtually until you took over 3DIV, your time in the army was dominated by the troubles in Northern Ireland and the Paris, particularly so, from the early days in Londonderry to Warren Point and even commanding 39 Brigade. How did you find the more conventional operations you were launched into subsequently, like the Balkans, Kosovo and Iraq, by comparison?
How long have we got, Harry? It's a profound question. Northern Ireland became a very measured, very tailor-made military response to aid to the civil power in part of the United Kingdom. Very specific. Now, our operating methods and some of our equipment, and which was devised for Northern Ireland, does read across into something less than all-out conventional war. So I remember thinking in my time in the Balkans, and that's how we did it in Northern Ireland. Does that transfer across? Is there something I can take from that experience? But you're right, in my time I did not become involved in a major conventional conflict. We were getting close to it in Kosovo, but fortunately we were able to avoid.
You've mentioned the K word. So who was it who took the decision to disobey Wesley Clark Sacker when he ordered the invasion of Pristina Airfield, held at the time by the Russians? Was it you or was it James Blunt?
I think it was me. James was a young officer in Hassel Cavalry, I think, if I remember rightly.
That's right, attached to the Blues and Royals, I think. He was attached
to the Blues and Royals. And James Blunt found himself in the forefront of the K4 advance on the 12th of June. He has his own story. I'm sure he handled the immediate situation with great aplomb.
I think it is. I asked him that question in an interview 2 weeks ago, and he immediately said it was due, sir. So, but I had heard other versions of it when he was talking elsewhere.
Yeah, but there had to be somebody who got to the airfield first. I mean, I didn't lead the charge personally, but
it would be wrong if you were.
Well, indeed. But the strategic balance which needed to be drawn was at the operational level, not the tactical.
But hindsight proved your judgment correct.
Kind of you to say so.
But did you ever consider, at the time, packing your bags, ready for recall by Field Marshal the Lord Walker, did you think you were going to have to come home and eat humble pie?
Yes. Yeah. It got to the point where I was quite clear, as were Four Marks, my own staff as well, because we actually did a independent estimate in the short time we had on that Friday, the 11th. To go ahead as originally directed would, the risk-benefit equation just simply didn't add up. The risk of it all going wrong, a hot shooting war between Western military and Russian military, it wasn't worth the candle, and I might have to put in my papers.
James Blunt actually said that the way they did, I think, was to sort of rock up and say, any chance of a parking space? And then something like that, within a week, we were exchanging ration packs and getting on very well.
I was quite clear that a Russian contingent was welcome, as it had been in Bosnia. The Slav connection, all of that. The manner and timing of their arrival was not exactly in the script, but, you know, you can work with that. And I was able to establish a rapport, I think that's not going too far, with the Russian commander, one General Zavazin.
He sent you a pistol, if I'm right, as a presentation gift, didn't he? Was a bottle of whiskey, I forget. Maybe both.
The pistol came from the KLA, which to them, of course, is a mark of great respect and all the rest of it, to a British general, and with our very proper rules about weapons, it's an embarrassment. and so as soon as I could, it was dealt with by an armourer and is now in the Airborne Forces Museum.
I always reckon that the most dangerous thing you could give any officer was a 9mm pistol.
Amen.
Yeah. one of the key questions a soldier will always ask is, have I got the kit, the assets to do the job with? In 2003, within weeks of taking over yet again from Michael Walker, this time as CGS, you had the unenviable task of reassuring yourself about the legality of the conflict to be joined in Iraq, and then ensuring the 45,000 men and women on the ground during the operation were under no illusion that the army was not at breaking point. Even then, these were manning levels that we couldn't sustain. You must have breathed a sigh of relief when the troops managed to pull the invasion off successfully.
Yes, I was relieved, certainly, but also immensely proud of our British Army and what was achieved with great skill. The battle for Basra was particularly well handled, in my view, and the timing of the eventual assault, if we can call it that, on Basra was spot on.
The Basra comes up again, and after you retired from the army, did you feel an element of I told you so, when in 2007, a year after you retired, the Americans relieved the British of command there?
Yeah. It's not the most glorious chapter in the British Army's history.
But one nonetheless I think that we have to face up to. I think it was...
The whole Basra withdrawal to the airfield, all of that, can be put down, not exclusively, but certainly force levels were frankly inadequate for the task we were continuing to have to do in securing Basra.
I didn't think that in discussing it, I didn't think it calls into question the tactical ability of our soldiery, but it does call into question the strategic input at a political level to give us the job, the tools to do the job, as Churchill might say.
Yes. In various guises, I always found that Whitehall Domain used the generic title was always very keen to get force levels way down once the initial kick the door in had been done.
As if manning and equipment weren't enough of your problems as CGS, a complete overhaul of the regimental system can only have added to the workload. Looking back, what are your thoughts on that restructuring today?
I'm glad we did it. And I say we advised it. It wasn't Jackson, it was the Army Board coming to a very carefully considered conclusion regarding particularly the infantry order of battle. My memory serves me right. We were 40 battalions at that time with four looming for the axe. We had the arms plot moving battalions every so often, between 3 to 5 years, I guess, into this role, out of that role, churning away. And we didn't have 40 battalions. In effect, we had about 30, at best, probably. And we came to the view that the arms plot, the moving of location and role, was just too big an overhead. But you could not remove the arms plot and remain on that rather odd infantry organisation we had, consisting of large regiments of 2 or 3 battalions and then single battalion regiments, and that we had to go to the large regiment, which of course we had got halfway to 25 years earlier. But what the Army Board failed to do then is to mandate the organisation. It urged regiments to go large, but did not push the point. And so we had this mixture. And I think now, I would hope that there's a structure there which can expand it when necessary. I hope not shrink when necessary any further. But it, and you know, one saw with great pleasure the success, say, of the Rifles, for example,
great
of the Yorkshire Regiment, for example. Scotland was difficult because of the particular clan nature of
the Lowland regiments, the Highland regiments, and
But I think, and I hope, although I got a lot of stick at the time, a lot of stick, but I hope as the time has gone by that the organisation we now have has bedded in, more than bedded in, and people now see the sense of having to take that step.
I mean, these were bold moves, and as you say, unpopular, right from the very top, from the mouth of the Queen downwards, I understand. But you always have the traditional lobbyists to fight. Do you feel in some ways that it would have been easy if you wiped the ball clean and said, right, we'll start with everything, and we'll just simplify everything even further? But the trouble is, I suppose, the tradition is always going to get in the way, isn't it?
Harry, I suspect the phrase "corps of infantry" is behind that question. Absolutely not. The regimental system has been the backbone of the British infantry down the centuries, and I, for one, would absolutely say no to a corps of infantry concept. But what the regimental system has adapted down the centuries, and if it didn't, we'd still be in numbers. When Cardwell said you've got to go county, not numbers, of course there was uproar. and then later when you said, well, these counties, there's uproar. We Brits we're a traditional lot, and it's one of our strengths, but you can't stand still.
On retiring, you were typically vocal in your criticism of the government and MOD's understanding and treatment of soldiery. What do you think of that understanding and their treatment of the soldiery today?
The difficulty is that the Ministry of Defence is two things, at least two things. The Department of State and the Supreme Headquarters of the Armed Forces. And these two bedfellows don't always rest very comfortably one with the other. The military side will, of course, because we're all brought up as from mother's milk to look after our soldiers. That is not how a Department of State shares that same value. And what they're looking for is really managerial efficiency. You don't always get the two sitting together.
No, no. In 2012, you took over as president of ABF, yes, the soldiers' charity, responsible for safeguarding the welfare of the Army's serving personnel and its many veterans. Then we were on operations in Afghanistan. Homelessness, the physical wounds, and the mental costs suffered by our servicemen and women were at the forefront of the nation's mind. Now that the band has stopped playing and it's Tommy do this and Tommy do that again, ABF will face some major challenges in the years ahead. What advice do you have in handing over to your successor, General Sir James Everard?
Before I answer the question, just as on the side, General James Everard was my military assistant in the Kosovo conflict.
He was my brigade major and full brigade too.
And so I'm delighted to see him taking over from me. It almost seems like full circle. The Soldiers' Charity, for which I have the greatest regard and took enormous pleasure in being its president, is a particularly, it's so close to home, that's the thing. And General James, I know he understands that. Any charity at the moment with the virus is not struggling necessarily, but some are not, I trust, the Soldiers' Charity. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge in fundraising, in doing its work, particularly under lockdown. That's now, of course, easing. But you're right. If we never did another operation, and that's a very big if, which I don't think will happen at all, but say we did, we still have a legacy, almost now, still back to the Second World War. There's a handful, isn't there? But then everything since 1945. And it's our proud boast that, you know, the charity's oldest beneficiary is, I think, is over 100. And the youngest, I think, is a babe in arms, born to a serving soldier with medical problems, and we're helping. And it's that huge range and the sense that a soldier, whether serving or retired, who needs help can turn to the charity and be sympathetically heard and helped when necessary.
So if you had to choose a single moment that you cherish the most in all those years serving the colours, what would it be?
I think I must say it would be the morning of the 12th of June 1999, when KFOR, the Kosovo force, after ups and downs and wondering how this situation is going to resolve, were able to advance into Kosovo on an agreed basis without a ground war. Because we were thinking a ground war is beginning to look inevitable as time went on. And the fact that Milosevic conceded, that we were able to get an agreement with the Serbs.
The Serbs, of course, were, as I recall in Bosnia, were formidable opponents.
No, a ground war between KFOR as it was in that summer, 14,000, and the then VJ, Vojska Yugoslavia, the old name was still being used, would have been a bloody, bloody one. They would have fought hard, I think.
Yeah. And I have to ask, what advice would you give to any young man or woman wishing to join the army today?
I would congratulate them on their choice of career. I would urge them to seize every opportunity, of which the army and the armed forces offer such a wide canvas on which you can get your paintbrush and paint your own picture. You can do that. You will, I hope, relish the comradeship of your fellow soldiers. In many ways, the army is one very large family, with each person, each man, each woman, depending on their comrades to get the job done, their brothers and sisters in arms. Go for it, is my advice.
You have shunned pruning roses as the fastest route to pushing them up. What does retirement mean for this general?
Retirement? I rather enjoy it. You know, I had a busy life in the service. I was extremely fortunate the way that everything panned out. But I've enjoyed retirement. I've written a biography. I do a bit of gardening. I read voraciously. I've got one or two irons in other walks of life. Although as time goes by, inevitably my sell-by date gets a little closer. So be it.
General Sir Michael Jackson, never dull, always exciting, and ever an honour to be in your company, sir. I'm grateful to you not only for being such a frank and willing guest here on General Talk, but on behalf of ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, and the women and men it supports, thank you for giving so generously of your time over the last 8 years as the charity's president. And what a great pleasure talking with you once again, General. Thank you so much. With editing by Michael Stigliani, this podcast has been a GameCube PR production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. Ta-da, there we go.